Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course we're on your smart speaker as well. Coming up, some breaking news. A senior MP, William Ragg, has admitted his involvement in a honey-trap sexting scandal targeting a minister and some fellow MPs. Plus, daylight robberies are hitting record highs as brazen criminals feel they can operate with impunity, while the police are too busy reading your tweets to stop hate crime. And the energy giants have only compensated 1,500 people despite forcing prepayment meter installations at hundreds of thousands of homes. Good evening, Britain, and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here on Talk TV. There's an awful lot to catch up on tonight. What will it take for the Tories to get your vote at the general election? A new forecast says Labour are going to win with a landslide of 400 seats, probably 401 now. Plus, the JK Rowling row rumbles on, with Scottish police being accused of making it up as they go along in regards to the Scottish hate crime bill. Plus, terrified fishermen claims to have seen Bigfoot prowling the South Downs. I'll speak to a woman who's on the hunt. This is my Independent Republic. Start the engines. You're in for one hell of a ride. So, a very good evening to you. A serving minister and a Labour MP are among a dozen politicians targeted by a honeytrap scandal in which sexually explicit messages and images were sent via WhatsApp in an attempt to gain compromat on British parliamentarians. Speculation, of course, is rife, with many wondering if it was Putin or China behind this plot. Well, apparently it wasn't. It was one of our very own, none other than William Ragg, MP. No, I'd never really heard of him either, but apparently this guy, he's only 36 years of age, he's called a senior Tory. He's apparently deputy chairman of the 1922 committee, which in many ways is regarded as the people who choose whoever is going to be the next leader of the Conservative Party. Joining me now, Henry Bolton, former UKIP leader, Candice Holdsworth, journalist and broadcaster, and, of course, Andrew Eborn, barrister and futurist. There we are. Welcome to all of you. Well, we were going to kick off talking about the ECHR and whether or not Rishi Sunak's promising to leave it actually means anything at all. But I'm far more excited and interested about this story about William Ragg, to be honest, because the story literally writes itself. You know, when you're a journalist, you're waiting for a splash. Yeah. This is it.
Oh, I'm going
7 o'clock tonight, broken on James Max show there by Aubrey Allegretti, the Times writer there. And apparently he's admitted his involvement in a honeytrap sexting scandal, where he basically handed over the personal phone numbers, believe it or not, of senior colleagues, including ministers. Yeah, incredible.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, many people out there will be thinking already that our members of parliament are really not particularly bright.
Not the full
this
ticket.
This man seems to be proving the point.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible. He's held a reasonably senior position in the Conservative Party. He's been there for quite a while. And he has done something so incredibly stupid.
He's also chairman, apparently, of a Commons Select Committee.
Yes, yeah. Extraordinary.
But what about, I mean, we talk about security all the time, Andrew. I mean, you've talked about AI and you talk about the dangers of people posing as other people. I mean, this is clearly a guy who's gone on to, what's it called?
Grindr,
which I'm told is a sort of gay dating app.
Yes.
It's less about dating and more about sort of shagging, basically. And he's got himself into a situation where they've exchanged pictures, they've exchanged words. This guy's asked him for numbers, and he's given them to him.
Well, firstly, an appalling abuse of trust by William Ragg. I think that the reaction of people... He's openly gay. As you look at his profile, most people will not know who he is until this is broken.
Unless you're on Grindr.
I'm not on Grindr. You can have a look later, but I'm not there.
Right.
You'll be a great relief. The reality is this. He was held over a barrel, but that's another story. What happened is he's given breached the confidences of his fellow MPs.
Right. But not only he's breached the confidences.
I think that's appalling.
Well, I hope there are serious questions being asked now as to whether or not security has been breached.
Well, I think Leicestershire Police are involved.
This is, you know, in the past, not just in this country, but there have been cases similar to this where people have actually got themselves into this sort of situation and been blackmailed into giving
traditional honey trap.
Information of national security value to somebody else.
Right.
So what is behind this? I don't know. It's for others to be investigating that, of course, but
It might just be, Candice, a sort of like what they call these things phishing schemes.
Yeah.
I
mean,
presumably if you hook one guy
and
he gives you six other people, then you've got potential to hook at least two or three more, like a pyramid scheme gone wrong.
Yeah, they call it spear phishing, apparently.
Right.
That's the name for it. I mean, it's just such low-caliber behaviour. I mean, you wonder if he was targeted for that as well, the fact that he is quite a weak-willed person. I mean, it's just like no loyalty to colleagues whatsoever, and then later trying to make excuses and make out like he was the victim.
Right.
And it's just yet another scandal for a Conservative MP.
Yeah.
I mean, how many have there been now?
The trouble is that this sort of happened. They basically, having given the numbers, which included several MPs, members of their staff and political journalists, they were then sent unsolicited messages by this person who identified themselves as Charlie or Abby. And apparently two of the MPs responded by sending explicit pictures of themselves.
Right.
Now, I always say history repeats itself because people don't learn the lessons from history.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you do, everything you say will get into the hands of the people you least want it to.
Right.
People have to work on that basis. There'll be lots of people worried now about that sort of side. But you raise an interesting point because it is about security.
It is.
And that sort of thing. When people first thought about this, look at history and how people have used sex to get spy secrets and so on and so forth on that sort of basis.
Well, exactly right. But, I mean, it says here again that person who is responsible for this identified themselves as either Charlie or Abby from a phone number with a profile picture featuring a man in a white T-shirt having a meal with a woman in a blue and white dress. Most people blocked it. Some people answered. Some people sent pictures. I mean, it shouldn't be that easy, should it, to access... people in government, because they do it.
But they need training on this, seriously. I mean, this is the way it's going to go
now. Do we need to train our national politicians to deal with this?
Yes,
we've got the wrong people.
We need to train them, because I think this is going to be the way that things are conducted in the future. There's going to be a lot of deception, there's going to be a lot of fakery, and you need to be incredibly discerning, because actually a lot of these scams can be quite clever.
Yeah.
No, you're entirely correct.
Absolutely.
Look, I mean, and I'm a bit sort of tongue-in-cheek when I say that, because the... wherever I have gone, when I was working in international diplomacy, you go to a new country, and I've always been briefed on the intelligence threat, and you know they cover things like this and many others. I'm sure that they do get those briefings. If they don't, they should do. You're quite right, but it also speaks to the level of common sense that our members of parliament have. And I don't want to point the finger at a Conservative MP who's fallen foul of this on this occasion, because it could just as easily be a member of any political party
absolutely.
Sitting in the House of Commons.
Absolutely.
And it worries me that I have that view.
Everybody's...
But hang on, might also find that, in fact, there are other party MPs that have been contacted, so it may well be, may have already happened. But the other thing that I find quite extraordinary, really, is the fact that, you know, most people, if they work for a reasonably good-sized company, if you're a member of the staff, and I know MPs are not staff members of anything, but surely they should all have encrypted phones, shouldn't they?
Yeah. Without it, and you're right, Mike, it applies not just for politics, but about company secrets and so on. There will be people out there at the moment in a similar position who are being held over a barrel, being blackmailed as a result of these compromising pictures.
But there's another point there as well. I mean, we're talking about members of parliament. There are all sorts of other people in this country who are occupying incredibly important positions, whether it might be in Rolls-Royce dealing with nuclear power plants, it might be, you know, in design of new military technology, who are all also susceptible to this. And I certainly, having worked with them, I'm certainly not in the business of criticising our intelligence agencies, who are they're swamped.
Yes.
But should we not be thinking about this sort of threat being directed not just as MPs, but on all of these other people who have information that's absolutely crucial to the well-being of the British people?
And it's not just giving away numbers. If you can give away secrets on that sort of basis, which is how the whole thing works. And also in the era of AI, you can make up these compromising pictures.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, if you're stupid enough, you could be done by somebody who says, actually, Rishi Sunak's on the phone and it's not him. Yeah. It's the
somebody
fake
sends
voice.
You a picture of yourself and you go, hang on, I don't remember that.
But let's talk about Rishi Sunak, because we were originally going to kick off the show with this ECHR situation. I've been saying for ages, why don't we just not make a big song and dance about leaving the ECHR and thereby apparently creating ourselves as a pariah in the rest of the world that we care about, but also just ignore it? Because that's what most of the other European nations do, isn't it?
That's absolutely true, Mike. We are, I think, the second most compliant nation in the ECHR. What, 46 or more countries part of it? And we're the second most compliant.
There's a lot of countries that are not part of it, of course.
There are. There are. But we are the most compliant, just about. Most countries do ignore those decisions and those that the court makes. But what really bothers me more than that about this is Rishi Sunak has no intention, in my mind, of pulling out of the ECHR. He knows that by the time it comes to having to make that decision, he's not going to be Prime Minister. It tells me that he's given up on the general election. It tells me, therefore, that he's not fit to be Conservative Party leader or Prime Minister. It also tells me that he doesn't really care about the immigration thing because he's got the Rwanda thing. I think what's going to happen, if he can get one flight off the ground...
Yes, then he will do.
And notice, if you look at the way he's changed subtly his wording when he's been speaking about this, it's no longer about stopping the boats.
No.
It's about getting a flight to Rwanda. And he, so long as he gets a flight to Rwanda, he will claim success. And then
he can claim success if he wants, but it won't be success.
Well, we must not let him get away with claiming that success.
Well, he's not going to be able to because, Candice, I mean, let's face it, this is not a guy who's going to be around for the long haul. I was driving back through central London this morning after I landed at the airport, and I think I saw his motorcade as I was coming past Downing Street, and I thought, he's not going to be in that very long, is he? The Range Rover's going to be gone, you know, the Outrider's going to be gone, the police Range Rover behind him is going to be gone, the blue lights are all going to be gone, and he's not even going to be leader of the Conservative Party in opposition.
Well, the thing is, I've noticed his rhetoric on this has become more hardline. It's sort of been like, well, we can work with them, we can find a way. Now we're going to leave the ECHR, which is something he's never said before.
But he's only saying he might leave the ECHR,
which
he could have said about a year ago.
You've got to find somebody to blame, and this is the reality, and I think the focus has to be on the abhorrent people, the people traffickers. And as you say, the thing about Rwanda has become such a crazy word anyway, it's a poisonous word. But people need to work out what the ECHR is, because there's a lot of confusion about it. And the reason it was set up was drafted after the aftermath of the Second World War and to basically protect people against the state.
It's grown beyond anything that it was intended to do back at the time.
Doesn't it have a duty to protect us
from
being invaded by hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants?
It does, but without going into all the... Andrew will sort of be able to talk better to this than I can, but, you know, we've got a difference between codified law in the rest of the European Union and common law here, and that's been actually a conflict that has created massive problems that has been never really been talked about. And here we have, therefore, a court that is working on codified legal principles that actually is at odds with our own thinking on this. So, and maybe Andrew wants to follow up on that, but the point is that we are not. We think that it should be there to protect us, but actually,
but it isn't.
It's not functioning in that way.
So there's a serious debate. We should just ignore it then, shouldn't we?
Well, in the past, we have been able to. So, I mean, you look at prisoners' voting rights, for instance. But then you had a lot of cross-party support. I mean, Labour and Conservatives coming together, and the ECHR backed off. But Labour are not going to do this now, not with an election looming. And also, I mean, Keir Starmer doesn't even want to enact the Rwanda plan anyway.
Yes,
no. I mean, if they get the supermajority, I don't know if they will, but if they get it...
I don't think that's going to be happening.
They'll do something totally different.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. The whole thing, this ECHR, Rwanda, migration, you've only got to watch the numbers of people coming in see that it's making no difference at all. There is no government policy.
Well, it's not deterring the crossings. It's not going to deter the crossings, certainly not in the numbers that Rwanda might end up receiving. Yeah. And as Andrew said, we're not really carrying the risk to the people smugglers.
Yeah.
You know, by the time somebody gets to North French coast, the reality is they've got really no way back.
Right.
They're there. They've got only a way forward.
So they might as well keep going.
So they might as well keep going. By that time, it's too late to deter them, way too late. We need to go after the people smugglers ruthlessly,
yes,
hunt them down, track them down, and work with the nation states along the route to prosecute them in their countries. You know, there's a whole lot we can do. We did it until 2006 when
absolutely.
Tony Blair pulled the funding on.
That's what Keir Starmer.
And as I say, imagine if you
that.
Had a European Court of Human Rights that could actually carry that law through.
You're right. And the crazy thing is,
we do have one, but they don't want to do it.
The crazy thing is, at the moment, Rwanda can only handle about 200 anyway.
Yeah.
The easiest way of getting sent back to the UK would be to commit a crime in Rwanda.
Yeah.
Bizarrely,
exactly.
So you have a look at that sort of stuff. The important point, however, and it's about controlling the narrative. We need to work out what the alternative would be, so that we don't become the pariah.
Right. I think the game is up for all of them. I think there's no point, really, in even having a conversation with them anymore. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here. Coming up, more political devastation for the Tories and some international war games in the mix as well. Do not go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. It's an uphill climb, to say the least, for the Tories in the next general election. And that climb got even steeper today, with the latest polls predicting a whopping 400-seat majority for the Labour Party. And the news about William Bragg doesn't exactly help their prospects, does it? All Starmer has to do now is stand still and watch the green benches turning red. Joining me in the studio now is editor of Spikes Online, Tom Slater, and political analyst Mike Indian. Evening to both of you. Thanks very much for joining us. And we probably would have talked a lot more about how Rishi Sunak's chances are literally disappearing faster than you can say, wipe out at the next election. And then we get this story about Mr. Bragg. And you just kind of, it's one of those, I just was saying to the panel earlier, it's like when you're a Fleet Street journalist, you sort of sit around waiting all day for a splash, and suddenly you get one. And you just go, well, that's it, straight on page one. Times have got it, brilliant story. What I find fascinating is that the default position was, well, it must be China or Russia. And it turns out it was just some bloke on, on Grindr who was maybe trying to make a bit of money. I don't know.
Well, you know, for a while, politicians have been blaming Russia for, elections that they're their way. You know, Trump gets elected, it was Russia. Brexit happens, it was Russia.
Yeah.
Now they're going to start doing it for their own sexual indiscretions.
Yes.
It's never-ending, really.
Right.
But when it rains, it pours, doesn't it, for scandals in the Tory party.
I mean, I can't think of a week that's gone by where there hasn't been another, potential by-election being
not another one,
I mean,
please.
Stop already, I mean, I'm quite glad Lee Anderson didn't want to have a by-election because, we just can't keep having them. There's got to be a general election soon, isn't there?
No, it feels like we're going to have a general election via by-election.
Yes.
So we'll just do one by one.
Just one at a time until we get to 600.
Yeah.
I mean, it is incredible, isn't it? I mean, I go away for a week and not that much has happened, but Sunak somehow managed to become even less popular in the 7 days that I was away, right?
It's an incredible feat. But is anyone really surprised? I get that when he first came in, the pitch was, I'm going to steady the ship.
Yes.
It can't get any worse than
right.
this. It can't get any worse than this trust, and he proved everyone wrong. But I think the problem was, he was the job of trying to rebuild the Tory party's credibility was never just about looking sensible and looking like you know your way around a spreadsheet. You had to be able to inspire people. You had to be able to come up with a message. And sending the kind of perpetual office junior that is Rishi Sunak out to do that was never going to be a good idea, but here we are.
Well, that's the trouble. He just doesn't inspire any kind of great faith or belief or anything. He looks like a guy who's been told what to say. Even if that's unfair, I don't know what you would say to
that. He feels like a management consultant has been brought in for a firm that's sort of two-thirds of the war team,
And you're firing a lot of people. Whatever you do, don't mention, that thing over there.
I mean,
say that.
Turning the oil tanker that was the Conservative Party's reputation around in the wake of the trust debacle was always going to be a tricky task. And I give the Prime Minister credit for setting targets, but if you set targets, stopping the boats, getting waiting times down, reducing inflation. To be fair, he has hit that one. You should probably hit them.
Right.
And for someone who's as technocratically minded as
he is... But he's one out of five, isn't he, though?
Exactly, He's technocratically minded, but unfortunately, he's not the man they need at the moment. And they're looking increasingly at people like Penny Morden.
Yeah.
This is all spurious because this poll that you quoted earlier, this sweep that's going to occur, is going to take basically all the leadership contenders bar Kemi Badenoch off the board because her seat is so ridiculously blue, it can never go Labour in a million years.
Yeah, we might play that back to you in September.
Well, there we go.
it's all gone Labour, I'm afraid. But, it's one of those quotes.
600 seats Labour.
No, I don't. But I'm not one that buys into this, actually, because I don't think that the public will swing that far. My feeling is that, Labour will win, but by not as big a deal as they think. And you can tell that they're a bit nervous. I was listening to one of their MPs talking this morning on the radio, And he was like, you know, we're not complacent, you know, we don't want to talk about winning huge by huge margins. We've got a lot of work to do, you know, we're still campaigning. Mm-hmm. So I think they know they can't, they're remembering, everyone here is remembering 1997. Everyone else is remembering the Labour Party in 1992.
Absolutely.
You know, when old Kinnock went up there and had the old Nuremberg speech, and that was the end of that.
It could be more like 2010 in the sense that you have a leader of the opposition who, although he represents change, has not convinced the public over the time he's been there that he's actually the force that they need to make their lives better. And that was David Cameron 12, 14 years ago. He didn't get
the overall
majority.
That'd be great if we had a 2010 again, because that was when Gordon Brown refused to move out of Downing Street, wasn't it?
that was right.
And he was like sitting there thinking, you know, if I don't leave, somebody will have to form a coalition with me.
Maybe it'll be fine. I don't think Rishi Sunak will have that problem.
It took a while for people to
go, no, constitutionally obliged to stay in office, I should point out.
Yeah, but he didn't have to physically sit in it until the time when somebody did
it. Sunak will be straight out, be dusting off that green card, he'll be telling the help at his Santa Monica flat to warm it up.
Yeah, maybe buy a bigger place out there.
Yeah, why not?
You know, but I mean, it is incredible that he has managed to sort of steward the ship into sort of basically the seabed.
It's a reminder, though, isn't it? Because his whole pitch was you need a technocrat. Like, we're in a complete crisis. You need a technocrat to sort it out.
Yeah.
The technocrats are the ones who got us into this mess in the first place, including Rishi Sunak, who presided over so many of the policies during lockdown, which dug the massive hole that we're in at the moment. So I think it's a good reminder that orthodoxy that we hear so much about has been pretty rubbish for us.
And also, I mean, you might say, if you were to be kind and sort of, you know, give him a break slightly, you could say he's been a bit unlucky, Sunak. Because, I mean, here we are talking about how low he is in the polls. And then we've got the Argentinian president laying out a roadmap for Argentina to reclaim the Falklands. Now, if he was Maggie Thatcher, he'd be straight down there and declaring war on them. But he's, you know, because that would win her the election. But it's not going to work for him, is it?
I don't think that any amount of foreign policy success is going to help Rishi Sunak close that poll gap at the moment. I mean, basically, we're still in the middle of the biggest cost of living squeeze in recorded history.
Yeah.
The Labour Party has successfully managed to detoxify and rebrand and rebuild its reputation. Starmer was polled 17 out of 17 ahead on all variety of characteristics, and that wasn't just representing change, it wasn't just identifying with voters, it was also things like management, the economy, security. These are traditional Tory shibboleths that have now gone entirely Labour. Like, this is how bad the Tory Party's reputation is.
Yeah.
How long is it going to be before we accept that this election could be a near-level extinction event, a meteorite hurtling towards the Conservative Party?
Well, I've said it before, I think the Conservative Party is, as it is now, kind of finished. I don't really see it coming back from this. I still don't think it will be as bad of a wipeout. But even then, the Conservative Party doesn't know what it is anymore, does it?
But it doesn't at all. And that's been borne out by the merry-go-round of leadership elections we've had in recent years. But I think it's also the fact that it's easy to forget how volatile things are in general. I mean, we were talking about the Labour Party being out of power for at least another 10 years, not that long ago. Things are incredibly volatile now. That's not to make excuses for the Tory party or not to say that they haven't screwed up in such a profound fashion. But it is incredible that, particularly because the historic bases of both parties have kind of frayed, they've kind of gone away, they've kind of moved around. Mm. Everyone's a floating voter now. Everyone's up for grabs. And a politician's fortunes can shoot up and descend almost just as quickly.
Right.
So a lot could change. But as you say, not in its current form, certainly the Tory party is definitely
different. And that move and movable kind of feast does change from week to week in a way, doesn't it? I mean, one week Reformer, you know, the new coming party, the next week, they've lost a load of candidates and so now they don't look so great.
Well, Reformer polling second place in a lot of seats, not just Tory seats, but Labour seats are in the red wall as well. So they could act like an anchor drag, keeping many of those Labour seats still in place. So Starmer, even if Starmer does end up with some form of majority, which would be impressive given he has to gain 125 seats just to get a majority of one.
Right.
The issue is then, what role would Reform play? Could we end up with a 2015 scenario where you have potentially millions of people going to vote Reform, but having no MPs? At least the 4 million voters got Douglas Carswell.
Yes.
So this is another example of why our election system needs looking at, because if people are, you know, Reform are polling well across the country, but they won't have any MPs, lots of people might feel even more disenfranchised.
But Labour have talked
do.
About this, haven't they? I mean, but presumably if they do get in with a big majority, they're not going to want to reform anything.
No,
they're going to go, it's just fine, we'll leave it as it is.
I mean, they were flirting with that when it seemed like they were going to have a spell in the wilderness and when it seemed like they would have to rely on the Liberal Democrats or the SNP or some combination thereof, they would have to cut some deals. Yeah. But as it is always the case with the two main parties. One of them, particularly the Labour Party, will get a bit interested in electoral reform. Then as soon as they eye a majority, all of that disappears.
And presumably the SNP will implode in some way up in Scotland with this hate act being such a shambles. You know.
I think arrest people for voting for them.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes. Brought in by old Humza Useless, and he's the one that most people have complained about.
They'll certainly lose seats at the election. I don't know if they'll implode to the degree that we think. They'll still be a pretty dominant force in Scottish politics. I think the real test for that will be in 2 years' time if Anna Sarwar can actually become the first Labour minister in over 15 years.
Right.
And as long as
I mean, I think they'll always have a grip in Scotland because of the system up there.
Absolutely,
but what they might not have any longer is the number of MPs.
Hopefully their record in government will begin to be scrutinised a lot more closely than it has been, because they have had that decade and a half, nearly 17 years by the next election, where they have been in power.
Yeah, it is absolutely incredible. So let's talk about a little bit about the Lib Dems, which we haven't done yet. I mean, are they doing anything? Because it seems to me this is a great opportunity for them to actually do something. All I see is sort of the smiling face of Ed Davey.
They're winning. They're winning by elections, which is.
Yeah, well, they always do that.
But, I mean, not always. Like, the party did come from a very low base, and I think Ed Davey's done a great job of rebuilding the... You know, he knows what he's going after. The blue wall seats in the south, in south-east and south-west of England are what the Lib Dems want.
I mean, shouldn't he be campaigning to rejoin the EU or something? Something that's a bit
I think
different.
He's caught on to the fact that even amongst Remainers, a lot of them are just kind of, let's just park that one. But also, I think he's been a tremendous beneficiary, as has the Labour Party to a certain extent, of the fact that in sections of kind of middle-class England, particularly, there's this very powerful kind of anti-Tory sentiment.
Yeah, yeah.
They almost don't care who they vote for as long as they're the anti-Tory candidate. And we saw that in many of those by-elections where there was tactical voting almost without much need for any coordination, campaigning. Yeah. People just naturally sorted into who's got the better chance and will vote for them and get the Tory out. That's really going to be a big problem for them.
Definitely that will be a big problem for them. But listen, thank you very much indeed. We'll speak to you some more in a little while. You're watching the Independent Republican, Mike Graham. After the break, lawless Britain continues with open thefts in broad daylight. Absolutely unbelievable. Stay exactly where you are. Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republican, Mike Graham, right here on Talk TV. Daytime thefts have hit a record high. Another one. And thieves are becoming more brazen by the day. Again, more than 7 in 10 thefts from a person, such as pickpocketing, and nearly half of bike thefts took place in the morning or afternoon while people were still at home. With me now is former Metropolitan Police Detective Peter Blexley. Peter, welcome to the Independent Republic. Nice to see you again.
Thank you.
We'll be seeing you on Plank of the Week, of course, this week as well. It seems extraordinary, doesn't it? We'll come to that in a minute, though, because I want to just run this other story past you. William Ragg, chairman of a Commons Select Committee and also a senior Conservative MP and deputy chair, vice chair, I should say, of the 1922 committee, has admitted to the Times that he handed over the personal phone numbers of colleagues to a man he met on Grindr, which, unless you didn't know what it was, is a gay dating app. It beggars belief, doesn't it?
It's absolutely astonishing. Mm. And, of course, the question is, well, why did he hand this very personal, sensitive and possibly compromising information over to somebody that he barely
knew?
That he met on a date site. There's an old expression, you know, that when you find yourself in a hole, stop digging.
Yes.
So if at the first instance when he realised that perhaps he'd had an inappropriate relationship and that possibly he may have been being blackmailed, for example, I don't know the exact details.
Right.
But let's just say
apparently he's openly gay, so it's not about that.
So they might be applicable in some way, shape or form. Then surely, as an MP, you go to the chairman of the party, you throw yourself at their mercy, confess to what you've done, and then make a bad situation better and not worse.
Yes. And apparently at the moment, the Leicester police, because they're acting because of an incident that involved a local MP in their area, they're investigating a report of malicious communications after a number of unsolicited messages were sent to a Leicestershire MP last month.
Yeah. Well, so, you see, and if, of course, Mr Ragg is being investigated, if, of course, for any form of malicious communication, there has to be an element of intent. But many people get prosecuted for that this day and age when so many people have smartphones and are sending inappropriate and unlawful messages and images to one another.
Absolutely right. Well, this is the thing. I mean, everyone who has a phone will have occasionally messages from people they've never seen before or heard from. A lot of people who are MPs got these messages and just completely blocked them. You know, I've seen messages on WhatsApp from people I don't know telling me that they've arranged a game of golf with me. And I just blocked them straight away.
Yeah, quite right.
I didn't do that. But let's go back to matters at hand and the crime that we saw just there in the streets of our cities and towns, because it is our cities and towns, though, isn't it? It's not just, you know, obvious daytime crime in supermarkets. We're seeing somebody there just did a bit of shoplifting or maybe even lifting stuff out of somebody's bag. You just have to be on your guard so much. I just came back from New York and I said to my two sons who were with me, you know, don't get your phone out, you know, don't stand around with money in your hand, you know, keep your wits about you at all times because, you know, you never know. London's like that now, isn't it?
And as I'm forever saying to young people, and I'm fighting a losing battle, I hasten to add, do not travel on public transport or walk around this great city with earphones in and your head buried in the phone.
Right.
Because you are cutting off two of the most important senses
right.
that will help you to not become a victim of crime.
Yes.
It's like trying to push water uphill, getting youngsters not to do that.
Oh, I know.
But
and also, don't wear those extremely expensive headphones, the big ones that people walk around wearing, because somebody's just take them off your head.
Exactly. And I was talking to a young lady the other day who had been a victim of theft person, in other words, pickpocketing.
Yeah.
She had her, her earphones in and her phone in her bag.
Yes.
And it was only... So a thief, unfortunately, takes the phone, is still within range, so she's still hearing things on her earphones.
Yeah.
It was only when, of course, the earphones went quiet and she exited the tube station, she looks in her bag for her phone because she thinks there's something wrong with the tech, and, of course, her phone's not there.
Right.
But, of course, when you're not focusing and concentrating and being aware of your surroundings, who's around you, what's around you... You're just primed for being a victim of crime.
Yeah, and it's right as well to say, isn't it, if you have more of a presence of police actually on the streets, there's less likely to be that kind of snatching of crime, you know, that kind of, you know, pickpocketing and you know, nicking people's bags and running off with them. If you see a police officer actually on the street who's not in his office trying to prosecute somebody for hate crime, that crime will go down, won't it?
Ah, but you see, because our police are all academics now... because they're getting degrees, and I'll give you an example of that from today. They all say there was a study many years ago that proved that actually having boots on the ground, so to speak, is not a great preventer
of crime.
Doesn't
make any difference.
But, of course, that's nonsense. How can you measure it? You can't tell what crime a police officer has prevented because it's unmeasurable.
Exactly.
But they don't see it like that. They compare it to
You can find, as I know from talking to many scientists over the years through COVID, you can come up with data that proves anything you want it to prove.
Absolutely.
You know.
There is an undeniable fact that people like to see, law-abiding people, like to see a police officer on the ground.
It's like having a police car on a motorway. People tend not to do 90 miles an hour past a police officer on the motorway. They'll stick to 70. If he's doing 70, they're not overtaking him.
Absolutely, and therefore they are preventing potentially accidents, law-breaking, fatalities, and so on and so forth. But we see so few of them these days because, of course, they're so busy... the frontline police officers going from one 999 call to another because it's now policing's like a breakdown service for your car.
Right.
You know, you've got the AA and the RAC.
Right.
If your car breaks down, you call them. Now, when society's called, you call the breakdown service, which is the police.
Mm.
And so many of them look at themselves as kind of social workers in uniform anyway.
Yes.
They don't like the rough and tumble of arresting people and thieves and all of that. And to go back to the point I mentioned earlier, today, Wiltshire Police published a 40-page magazine, and it's called Academia into Reality.
Oh, yeah.
OK, because the whole police service appears to be getting obsessed about academia. Mm. And within it, they've got constables writing articles as if they're great learned professors in some way, shape or form.
Why?
And you think, do you know what? Why aren't you out on the street nicking villains?
Nicking the villains.
Gathering evidence and locking them up. Because that's what the public wants.
Exactly. Do you know, this morning I had a very strange experience, which was driving back from the airport with my two kids, and we came through central London, you know, around Constitution Hill, around Buckingham Palace, over Westminster Bridge, you know, past Downing Street. We saw, I think, Rishi Sunak's motorcade going around towards Downing Street, you know, two police cars, you know, outriders and all that. Suddenly, there was two police outriders behind me. And I thought, that's unusual. And they sort of followed me through over Westminster Bridge. And then they disappeared off somewhere. And then next thing, I got to the other side. And this is a bit local for people. Other side of Waterloo. And then there was four police motorcycle outriders behind me. And I thought, now, are they giving me an escort because they've recognised me and they've recognised what a lovely car I've got? Or am I now seeing... Because I don't think I've ever seen that many police in the same space of about 20 minutes.
Well, of course, it is the most policed part of the country.
Yeah.
You've got the Houses of Parliament, Downing Street, Buckingham Palace down the road.
Yeah, but why the motorcycle? And they all seem to be in groups of two or four.
Well, I suspect they probably wanted an autograph but were too shy to flag you down. But, you know, who knows?
But no, I just find it just strange. Just, you know, one thing you're used to now not seeing in the city is any police officers.
Yeah, and ditto for around the rest of the country, yeah. Sadly. There is perhaps a realisation that neighbourhood policing is really important.
Yeah.
And that because it was sacrificed on the altar of austerity and counter-terrorism policing over the last 10 or 14 years, that it needs to be built back up.
Yes.
It's really important. Mm. But the whole thing about trust and confidence in the police, which is absolutely tanking,
right.
Because the police are not doing what the public fundamentally want, that largely is born out of the fact that the police turn their back on the crimes that affect so many of us, the moderate majority. House burglary, car theft, bicycle theft. Bicycles could be worth £4,000 or £5,000 these days.
Yeah.
Phone theft.
Yeah.
Shopkeepers with a shoplifting. They have my absolute sympathy. And the elephant in the room that nobody likes you to talk about, fraud. Because so many millions of people are victims of fraud and the police barely touch it.
Yeah.
So consequently, because the public don't meet police officers coming to them to investigate those crimes, even if they're not going to solve them, there's not that interaction.
No.
And the respect has gone. And I think the current model of policing, if it carries on down the current direction of travel, policing as we know it will be completely stone dead within about 10 years.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing, but I think you're absolutely right. Peter, thanks for coming in. Peter Blexley there with it. Some bad news for anyone who likes to see the police actually doing more of what they're supposed to be doing. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. After this, the scandal of forced prepayment meters and the Scottish police, who apparently are making up hate crime laws as they go along. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for Taking the Mic. I was asked a question this week. Is Britain finished? And the question isn't as stupid as it sounds. Because consider this. We are a country drifting rudderless in a sea of change, seemingly incapable of any direction. We are a country where the health service is no longer fit for purpose. We are a country which wrongly accused and prosecuted scores of people who ran sub-post offices. And that's just for starters. We're also a country where over 9 million people make no contribution whatsoever to our economy. And who would rather loaf around than actually get a job? The short answer to the above question would appear to be definitely yes. And here's something else to add to the list. We are a country which allowed energy companies to install more than 150,000 prepayment meters in homes that hadn't asked them to. That's right, people were forced to have a prepayment meter put into their homes from various gas and electricity companies. Last year, Ofgem, the rather hapless regulator, finally managed to do something. They ordered the energy companies to investigate how it could have happened, and they ordered compensation to be paid if it was due. But it looks like, and you will not be surprised to hear this, that the system isn't working. Only 1,500 people have actually received compensation, totalling £342,450. And there are supposedly plans for payments to 1,000 more customers, totalling £200 each on average. In other words, the energy companies will have handed out £500,000 to 2,500 people since the Ofgem order last year. How utterly ridiculous is that? You know that some people will say that if you were forced to have a prepayment meter installed, you were probably failing to manage your household budget and failing to pay your bills. But consider this. Of 150,000, you're going to tell me that 147,500 of them deserve to be treated like that? These huge utility companies are acting like profiteers. They rinse every single penny they can get out of hard-working people. They force direct debits onto people's bank accounts and they give no quarter if you're having trouble paying. Lots of these meters were installed between January 22 and January 23. And as a result, a lot of people turned off their heating and hot water. Many disconnected their energy meters altogether. And many elderly and vulnerable people deserve to be treated better. It's time to demand much better behaviour from these giant companies. And we'll come back to that story later on in the show. But Police Scotland have been accused of making it up as they go, as discrepancies have emerged in the recording of hate crime allegations about J.K. Rowling. It comes as a former officer said police have been pulled from other parts of the force to deal with hate crime complaints made under the SNP's new law after more than 3,000 complaints were made. A very slippery slope indeed. for Democracy. Joining me once more, editor of Spiked Online, Tom Slater, journalist and broadcaster Candice Holdsworth, and lawyer and broadcaster Andrew Eborn. Welcome back once again, guys. I mean, this story is something that I watched from afar over the course of the last few days, unravelling and sort of peaking, I suppose, in stupidity, when it turns out that the person who's been most complained about is old Humza Useless, as I like to call him. You know, he's managed to kibosh his own job. I mean, it's a sort of special Harry Kerry that the SNP leaders do, isn't it? You know, exactly. Nicola Sturgeon already sacrificed her career on the altar of transgender madness, and he's doing the same thing.
Absolutely, and he's quite literally kind of signed his own death warrant. Yeah. In this respect. The fact that he's become the number one complained against hate criminal in Scotland because his own piece of legislation, as Justice Secretary, yeah. he ushered this thing through Holyrood.
Right.
It's absolutely perfect. I can't have been the only one who lost whole mornings calling up Police Scotland, making their complaints. And it's just complete farce. I mean, they received almost between 3,000 and 4,000 complaints in the first 24 hours.
Right.
Scottish police generally get about 900 complaints a day, full stop.
Right.
And the fact that in the run-up to this, do you remember when they said, a few weeks back, they said, we're stretched at the moment with police, there's a lot going on, so we're only really going to attend some crimes, we're going to take a proportionate response. These, they've said, they're going to investigate every single one. So it's a mess of their own making, from Humza
Useless. They've created all of this, haven't they?
But what a mess it is.
I know. And Candice, apparently, they've already come out, the police, and said that so far, of all the complaints made against J.K. Rowling, slightly fewer than have been made against old Useless, that they don't reach the level of criminality that causes them to charge anybody with a crime.
And what a lot of people have said, well, this is quite inconsistent with what you were saying before.
Right.
So, I mean, it just goes to show the whole thing, I mean, is so ill-planned. I mean, there is no way that they can actually start prosecuting people like J.K. Rowling for so-called misgendering. I mean, there's just no way. It would make them look an absolute laughingstock. How are they going to implement this exactly?
Well, Andrew, presumably any decent barrister would demolish this in a court of law and say, you're basically trying to make it illegal for people to say things which are true.
Exactly. And
I mean,
the reality
doesn't make any sense.
It's always freedom of speech, but not freedom from consequences. And actually, J.K. Rowling, as in Bowling, to her absolute defence, basically tested people.
Right.
So, look, come and arrest me.
Yeah.
I'm going to say this. I'm going to say biological men are biological men. That's the end of the story.
Right.
And if that's a hate speech, then let me know.
Right.
And if that full fails,
come and arrest me.
Exactly. So that was her taunt, if you like, to the police. It was a victory for her on April Fool's Day.
Well, it's a victory for common sense.
And that's what happens. Sure. And it's this two-tiered test. So the first is whether the person actually behaved in a manner that was a reasonable person would consider to be threatening or abusive. So that has to be reasonable. It's not just the victim. And the second test is whether the person intended to stir up hatred.
Yeah.
So you need to look at both those.
But all of those, but both of those things are completely subjective,
yes,
aren't they?
That's
and
the
also,
difficulty.
The one group of people that doesn't appear to be protected here is Candice women, right?
Yeah.
They said they're working on something.
Oh, good.
Oh, no. I don't even want to know what that is going to look like. I mean, that could look absolutely terrible. I mean, it'll be all kinds of things. It could be like microaggressions. Yeah. And things like that.
Yeah.
You know, putting a hand on a knee. I mean, just really, really ridiculous things.
Right.
If we can look at this as an example of what to look forward to. This is the whole problem with having these sort of definitions of hate.
Well, it's woolly. It's woolly language. Yes. And that's the real problem about people have to enforce it. And when the police come out and say they investigate every single complaint, if they don't do that, it's a nightmare. If they do that, they're going to miss out on other things as well. But just to put it in perspective, the legislation basically broadened. The problem originally was about racial hatred.
Yeah.
They then added other characteristics of disability, religion, sexual orientation, age and transgender, but didn't mention sex. So, in other words,
so they're trying to cover all the bases
it?
And failing.
Yeah.
Do you think, Tom, this is a result of kind of the way that society has become, where politicians think that they can reshape it? They suddenly think that, you know, when I finish being First Minister of Scotland, I want to be known as the man that, you know, did this and I changed the world.
Ended hate.
I ended hate.
No, yes,
I
mean, absolutely.
I was saying to you earlier, there's an old firm game on Sunday at Ibrox, with the world headquarters of Rangers Football Club, where Celtic and Rangers fans will be literally baring their teeth and bawling at each other, all sorts of horrible sectarian stuff. And they tried this once before with flags because they tried this sectarian law, I think it was under Alex Salmond, and they said that all sectarian flags would be banned from the game, which would have been fine, except for the fact that they bring union flags to the game. They bring Irish tricolours. And people started going, well, hang on, that's not a sectarian flag. It's a national flag.
I remember that. Well, that was actually called the Offensive Behaviour at Football Act.
Yes.
If you're going to clamp down offensive behaviour at football, you have to arrest the whole stadium.
Yeah, exactly.
Cases.
And they couldn't
but
do that.
This is the SNP, though, is that they claim to want to liberate Scotland. They claim that Scots are under the boot of England. They don't trust these people to go to a football match on the tip. They don't trust these people to have conversations.
In fact, you might say some of the things they say about the Westminster government and Parliament are quite hateful.
Yes, you know, they're definitely hateful.
But this is why you can't police hate, because at the end of the day, one man's hate preacher is another man's freedom fighter.
Yes.
So therefore, the state should get out of the business of deciding what this
is. But that's the problem for everybody in the game, because they're trying to work out for those who have to enforce it. I do feel sorry for the police.
They've invented it, as Tom said. It's, you know, nobody asked for this.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. But if you're empowered, basically responsible for enforcing it, you need to have certainty. Woolly language, subjective language, is not helpful.
Mm-hmm. And it's going to be misused so badly. People are going to use this vendettas to settle Twitter feuds.
Right.
That's what it's going to be so tempting for them to bring the police
in. We've seen Twitter become a place where people threaten each other with lawsuits all the time. There's more lawsuits now because of people saying things on Twitter than I think there have ever been. Yep. And there's also evidence from the law and from courts where they're saying, don't bring your, you know, poxy Twitter feuds to court. Mm. It's a waste of court time.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Get over yourselves and stop suing each other all the time.
Yes, be a bit more resilient, toughen up a bit.
Yeah.
We would be so much better if we just remembered that old kind of sticks and stones.
Yeah.
People being rude to you on the internet is not the worst thing that's ever happened to you.
Go
outside.
The laptop.
Talk to someone in real life. It will be fine.
One of the good things which has happened in the last few hours is that previously they said that if a crime was reported against you, you would go on as the person who's been alleged to have committed it. Now what happens is the person who reports it goes on. So it's actually the focus is trying to get people to stop.
Right. But haven't they also done something which is meant to be no longer a legal recourse in law, which is they've started to record, as some people say, some of J.K. Rowling's interventions as non-crime hate crime, which in England, the constabularies are supposed to not be doing anymore.
Well, that's one of those ones where every Tory Home Secretary says you've got to stop doing this, and they just carry on doing it. And this is really Orwellian, that phrase is a bit overused, but non-crime.
Yeah.
It's like pre-crime. It's like
things that can show up on a CRB check, for example.
Exactly.
You wouldn't know they're on there.
And we're talking about these things being subjective. This is absolutely subjective. Someone got a non-crime hate incident recorded against Amber Rudd because of a speech she gave about immigration that he later admitted he never actually heard.
Right.
So this is the sort of scale of how credulous the police are, but as ever, it shows you that the police do bear some responsibility for this nonsense as well, because they've been told to stop doing it and they carry on doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, the mischief you're trying to guard against, actually, it's going to encourage people to try and push the boundaries of the law. So for those who want the protected people in that sort of basis, people are going to turn around and will say, "Hey, well, J.K. Rowling said this, I'm therefore going to say this," and more people are going to take part as a result of it.
Even more reason why it should never have been done.
Yeah. No, there's something very Salem about it all.
Yeah.
Something very pre-Enlightenment. You know, people pointing fingers at each other and trying to use the law and the courts to hurt one another instead of being able to just settle things themselves, to engage in debate with themselves.
Also allow people to have opinions which you might not like, even if some of them might be borderline, you know, racist or, you know, fascist or communist or whatever they are. You know, it's not illegal to have an opinion that's different.
It's not illegal to think, and that's the essence of freedom of speech. You have to embrace and listen to views that you disagree with.
Yeah.
Yes,
but this is not modern politics, is it? Modern politics, if you're on the left particularly, suggests that if you're on the right, you must be, one, a horrible person, two, a bigot, three, at least a racist of some strain or other. You know, they don't allow any, you know, discourse really about anything.
No. Yeah.
And when they do have it in the Labour Party, for example, about Gaza, you know, they all start, you know, sort of tearing each other to shreds.
Yeah, and that's the one form of free speech people on the Labour left these days will defend, is for your right to say dodgy to anti-Semitic things about Israel. But there is a problem, definitely on the left, as you say, Mike, where people think we're just one more ban away from utopia.
Right. Like
if you stop people saying things, everything's going to be perfect.
Yeah.
Not only is it stupid, it's also really dangerous. Mm. It leads us down the road of not just farcical restrictions, but really authoritarian.
Yeah, and it's all wrong. We'll come back to this in a little while because there's much more to say. Thank you, guys. You're watching The Independent Republican, Mike Graham. Coming up at 9, I'll be sharing what I learned while I was in America last week and the international impact of Israel's strike on AIDS workers. We'll see you then.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Good evening and welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here. You're with Talk TV. We're on radio, we're online and we're on your smart speaker. Coming up, more strife for Rishi Sunak, who is under pressure from UK judges, intelligence experts and cross-party to stop the sales of British arms to Israel. Plus, no chance for an NHS appointment now as the waiting list is 2 million more than we thought it was. And I just hope you won't need the NHS anytime soon following reports of a Bigfoot sighting. I speak to a paranormal investigator who describes seeing this creature with her own eyes. Now, it's never a good idea to underestimate America, whether it's the wokery of Hollywood narcissists or the foreign policy of a hawk-like president who wants to go to war. Britain will inevitably catch the cold that starts on the other side of the Atlantic. I just got back from a week over in the States, and I'll have plenty to tell you about it over the next few days and weeks. But let's just take a quick stock check of what I noticed. The roads in New York City are more congested and crowded than ever before. Sensible people will warn you not to take the subway as there are so many crazy people around. America is not enthusiastic about Joe Biden winning another term in the White House, and people want the economy to get back to normal as soon as possible. As for illegal migrants, if you think we've got a problem, try watching a porous border with Mexico that has let in 4 million people illegally since last year. The big difference, though, between Britain and the USA remains its optimism, its pride and its faith in itself. Yes, the people will honour the office of the President of the United States, though that has changed slightly more recently. But more importantly, they are proud of their country, of what it means to them, of what it says about them. It may not always feel like the land of the free and the home of the brave, but America's self-belief is a powerful thing. Underestimate it at your peril. Everywhere I went, people wanted to ask questions about Europe, about what it's like. So few Americans still travel beyond their borders. Everywhere you go in America, you see the stars and stripes, the national flag. And it isn't painted in weird purple and blue colours either. When I travelled to more rural parts of Connecticut, a state just north of New York, I saw an awful lot of flags. I also saw an awful lot of Trump banners and posters calling for him to make America great again. The heartlands of America believe in Donald Trump. They believe he can make the country great again. I saw no posters or bumper stickers for Joe Biden. Aside from the usual Trump haters, most Democrats believe it's foolish to write the Donald off. Only last week, he visited the widow of a police officer who was shot dead in the line of duty after making a traffic stop. He attended the wake for Officer Jonathan Diller, and he said this.
You know, they're not given the respect. The police are the greatest people we have. There's nothing and there's nobody like them, and this should never happen. I just visited with a very beautiful wife that now doesn't have her husband. Stephanie was just incredible. Their child, brand new, beautiful baby. They're innocent as can be, doesn't know how his life has been changed. But the Diller family will, you'll never be the same, you can never be the same. And we have to stop it, we have to stop it. We have to get back to law and order, we have to do a lot of things differently. But this is not working, this is happening too often.
His appearance was in stark contrast to Joe Biden, who arrived in the city the same day for a fundraiser where he was met by previous presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, the three stooges, they were called by some commentators. Once again, it's the liberal elites against the working classes. Don't be surprised when the Donald wins again in November. Now, later on in the show, we'll have a look at all the front pages as they come into the show. But first, let's have a quick look at tomorrow's very serious Metro front page, which brings you the latest on a story of a missing soldier. And the headline says, tied up and trapped in a river. We'll bring you more details on that, of course, as we bring them to you later on. Coming up, though, British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is facing even more growing political pressure to stop selling weapons to Israel after seven aid workers, including three British nationals, were killed by an Israeli air attack on Gaza. It comes as US President Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, are due to have their first direct talks since the strike. But despite tensions over the conduct of the war, the US government is continuing to supply arms to its ally. Now, I'd like to bring in former British Army officer Colonel Richard Kemp to ask him his opinion of what happened, of course, over there in Gaza when those aid workers were killed. Colonel Richard, very, very warm welcome. Thanks for joining us here at the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. I've been listening to a lot of opinions on this over the course of the last 24 hours or so. Some people asking for Britain to stop supplying arms to Israel. My understanding is that Britain only supplies about 0.02% of Israel's arms, and many of those are components of bigger pieces of kit, if you like. I've heard also Israeli spokesman saying that, you know, we will go it alone if we have to. If we get the rug pulled by the international community, we are still going to go after Hamas because that's what we have to do.
Yeah, on those weapons or the arms, shall we say, sales from Britain to Israel, Britain doesn't supply any arms to Israel, any weapons to Israel. What it does supply is some minor components, maybe important components, but a small number of components for some of Israel's military equipment, many of which actually are not used by Israel. They form parts of weapons that are exported by Israel to other countries. Yeah. So the effect of a British arms embargo on Israel would be absolutely zero, in reality zero, pretty much. It would obviously be a performative gesture. It would be intended to damage Israel's prosecution of this war. On the other hand, Israel supplies some very significant weaponry to Britain, something like, I think it's 2.7% or something of Britain's total arms imports. And it does include things like drones, it includes anti-armor missiles, it includes tank protection systems, things like that, some very important equipment. So if Israel were to reciprocate, we'd be on, without a doubt, on the losing side of that.
Right.
As far as what happened in Gaza is concerned with the World Central Kitchen, none of us know at present. There's an investigation going on, and no doubt we'll find out how this terrible, terrible incident came about. Almost certainly it was a catastrophic mistake as a result, perhaps, of human error, of procedural errors, of bad communications, lack of coordination, those sort of areas, I would have thought. But tragic nevertheless. Unfortunately, these things happen all the time in war. All you've got to do is think back. I mean, President Biden has said how outraged he is by this action by Israel. It's tragic, but it's not something I don't think you should be calling outrageous. I'm sure it wouldn't have been deliberate. We'll see. I doubt it. But all you have to do is think back to 2021 when President Biden's forces were withdrawing from Kabul and they struck. There was a drone strike against what they thought was a terrorist group, but it was in fact an aid worker and nine members of his family, including seven children. This is not an exceptional incident, unfortunately. It's due to the kind of chaos, pressure, confusion, human error that you get in war. It's tragic, but it's reality.
Well, once again, we're also being held up here as Israel to a completely different standard. I mean, as far as I understand it, the US gives plenty of military aid to Saudi Arabia. They have many, many military installations there. They help to train the Saudi Arabian pilots that are dropping bombs on Yemen. I'm sure there are plenty of instances, if you wanted to find them, of bombings that went wrong, bombings that killed civilians, orders that killed civilians, possibly with American weapons. I don't see Joe Biden, you know, having a go at America for that.
No, you're absolutely right. And he gave the orders. In what, there was one case when he admittedly was vice president in 2015 when the US carried out a series of airstrikes against a hospital in Kunduz in Afghanistan, as a result of which something like 42 people were killed and around 30 or more wounded. Terrible, terrible incident, but it was a tragic accident. It's what happens in war. And, of course, Britain is not without these sort of things happening. And it's very similar, actually. The kind of attack on the World Central Kitchen is not dissimilar to a sort of blue-on-blue attack. And I personally have been involved in a number of blue-on-blue attacks in different theatres. And no one will ever accuse, I hope anyway, no one will ever accuse British or American troops of deliberately shooting at their own side. It's what happens, unfortunately. And the Israelis will undoubtedly learn from it. They will no doubt change their procedures. They'll try and prevent this happening again, but it will happen again. It'll happen time and time again, not just in this war, but in all other wars. It's an unfortunate function when people decide to go to war. Right. And we shouldn't forget for a moment that every death, every wound, everyone that's going hungry in this conflict in Gaza is down to Hamas. Hamas started the war with a massacre on the 7th of October. They kidnapped dozens of Israelis and are still holding many of them, over 100 hostage in Gaza now, where they're being abused, tortured and sexually mistreated. Without that attack, none of this would be happening. So okay, every side, particularly obviously the Israelis, being that they're a democratically accountable armed forces, are responsible for upholding the laws of war. They must do that.
Right.
But despite that, the culpability here, the real culpability, is with Hamas.
Exactly right. And, I mean, in terms of the sort of intelligence relationship between the UK and Israel and the US and Israel, is that in any way in danger at the moment? Because, of course, one of the things that we have with Israel and solidarity is a common enemy being Hamas, you know, and being Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, which we've all suffered from in one way, shape or form. So, I mean, because of the way politically things are happening, would you say that there's a danger that our intelligence relationship, if you want, and what we share with each other is in some kind of jeopardy?
Britain and Israel are two of the closest intelligence partners of any two countries in the world. And Britain gains enormous benefit from that relationship. So does Israel. But Britain, I would say, is the net beneficiary, particularly in relation to Islamist terrorism. I used to work in the intelligence world a few years back, and I could personally tell you details of ways in which British lives were saved on numerous occasions, whether it be in Afghanistan, Iraq, here in Britain or elsewhere in the world, as a direct result of Israeli intelligence. That goes for pretty much every other country. That relationship is strong. I believe, knowing the Israeli intelligence world as well as the British intelligence world, I believe even if there's a severe breakdown in relations between Britain and Israel, Israel will still provide vital intelligence to Britain, irrespective of what's happening on the political scene. They consider it more important, I think, to help Britain to save lives of British citizens than what's happening on the other side. So I'm not directly concerned now with a loss of that relationship. I think it will be maintained.
Yes. And I mean, I was listening, as I say, earlier on today on Talk TV to an Israeli government spokesman who talked about now the toll of Israeli soldiers is up to about 600 deaths in the Israeli Defence Force. But when told that, you know, the public opinion was turning against him, he said, well, it's not in Israel, because we hear an awful lot, don't we, of people saying this is all down to Netanyahu. You know, it's his politics that have caused all of this trouble because he has invited the extremists into his government. I mean, I don't particularly go along with that view, and I don't think it should change anything that Britain does. But what do you make of that?
No, I mean, I've spent virtually all of the last 6 months since the 9th of October inside Israel. There is immense unity in Israel. The vast majority of the population know and support the necessity for this war. They know that their survival depends on the defeat of Hamas. And then undoubtedly it will become necessary also to fight Hezbollah at some point. I don't know when exactly. But there is tremendous unity in Israel. Like most other democracies, Israel is a divided country. There are people who hate Netanyahu, there are people that love Netanyahu. But right now, the vast majority are right behind him in this war. We have actually seen in recent days, we've seen some even slightly violent protests going on in Israel against the government. But it's marginal, I think. It's a small number of people, the sort you'd expect to find in any democracy, really. And I think that the unity of this government is probably pretty much unchallenged in any significant way. And interestingly, actually, one thing that your viewers and listeners may not fully appreciate is that the Israeli Arabs who live inside Israel, I'm not talking about in the West Bank or Gaza, of course, but the Israeli Arabs, The strength of support for the state of Israel and for this war has gone up enormously since the 7th of October. So it's not just the Jews in Israel, it's also the Arabs who are behind what Israel's trying to do here.
Absolutely right. Colonel Richard Kemp, thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure. That's the latest there coming in from former British Army Commander Colonel Richard Kemp. Now, speculation is swirling online after a story about a group of fishermen's freaky experiences in the South Downs. Now I'm back, I'd like to get to the bottom of it. I'm joined now by a woman who follows cases like these professionally, cryptid and paranormal investigator, Deborah Hatswell. Deborah, a very good evening to you. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. This is a fascinating story, this.
It is a fascinating story, Mike. Unfortunately, it was taken out of context and reported incorrectly in the Daily Star. The gentleman himself never saw a creature at any point. He's had some really frightening experiences. But there are lots of witnesses to the British Bigfoot in the UK.
Yes. Well, while we look at some pictures, just tell us about, you know, the numbers of these kind of sightings, because it's one of those strange mysteries of the world that we'll never perhaps ever solve, that, you know, in almost all parts of the world, there are sightings like these. And it's, I mean, I'm one of those people that says to people who doubt it or doubt that it's a creature or think that it's some kind of guy in a suit, you know, we know so little about so many parts of this world where things could live and where creatures could quite happily coexist with other creatures, that, you know, for people to just go, oh, that's just rubbish, it couldn't possibly be true, I think they're in the wrong there, aren't they?
I would agree. I mean, some of my witnesses are in the army, some of them are lawyers, police officers, paramedics, a number of teachers, very erudite people in the UK. See these creatures often and all across the world.
Right. And in terms of what you do, I mean, are you able to sort of look at these pictures and delineate which of them are like more likely to be genuine, or could you, can, I mean, have you got a way of kind of analysing them to see what it is that you're looking at?
Well, we have experts that are happy to do it on a volunteer basis. So anything that comes in, a hair sample, a footprint, a photograph or a video, I'll send that off to the experts and they'll do the analysis on it. Mm. I work with the victims, so they will come forward to me. I sit down with them and hear their story and go out to the area with them where the account happened so we can get a size comparison.
Right.
And we can see the witness talking about the encounter at the actual place where it happened. Some of them have some trauma from the event. As you can imagine, seeing an 8-foot hairy creature is not something that everybody delights in. No. And then I kind of work with them on that trauma to get them back out into the countryside again, like the fisherman who doesn't want to go fishing again after his experience.
So can you tell us a little bit about his experience? Tell us what happened to him and what he told you.
He was fishing, night fishing, typical, and he was hearing something at the back of his bivvy. And that's quite common in the reports that come in.
So he was fishing, he was on land with his rod somewhere in the river?
Yeah, that's what he was doing. And he could hear something running about behind him. Right. And that feeling that people often report in the woodlands of being watched, as if something's watching them from the woodline. He's had a number of paranormal reports throughout his life experiences, I should say. And some of the images that you're showing now are actually picked by the witnesses themselves, or actually drawn by the witnesses themselves to explain what they've seen. It's a good way of trying to show somebody, actually. Right. For me, I was 15 and nobody believed me. So I sat down with this image with a police artist and I came up with that.
Right.
That's what I saw in an ordinary town in Manchester, believe it or not. But seven other people since then have come forward and they explained that they've seen him as well.
Right. And how long ago was that when you were, well, I mean, I'm sorry, I don't want to say you to be specific when you were 15, but, you know, so you saw that creature in Manchester?
Yeah, in 1982, I'm 57 now, Mike, and I've been researching since the moment I went home.
Wow.
I wanted to know what it was. Was it, you know, was it a time slip? Was it a ghost? Yeah. Was he a caveman of some kind?
Right.
Nothing out there for me, nothing really. I didn't discover the American Bigfoot until I was in my 20s, so it wasn't something I'd had I'd known about. But as I say, that there's eight other people have come forward now, last sighting being in 2021.
Yeah.
And often when I release it, somebody will put on Facebook or YouTube, I remember that tale from that town, but the man who saw it. So lots of the locals have heard it.
And a lot, I used to do an overnight radio show, and a lot of people used to call in and tell me stories about things that they'd seen, and some of them were alien-related, some of them were like you, sort of Sasquatch-related. And people would always ask the question, the people who doubt these stories would always say, oh, but surely everybody's got a phone now, why doesn't anyone take a picture? But, I mean, I suppose that's not an easy question to answer, is it?
It's not, but one of the photos you showed them was from Carbon in Ireland, and that was taken in, let me just get the date correct for you, that was taken in June of 2023 by a man called Billy Morgan. He was actually out in the woodlands walking in Carbon, and he found some strange structures. Right. And he took photographs of the structures themselves.
Right.
He went back home, showed them to his daughter, and his daughter pointed out, what's that? And it looks like a head and shoulders that's right. looking at him from the woodland. Right. And he, this one, this image that you've got up now, so right. if your viewers can look between the two tall trees, you can see a strange anomaly there.
Yeah.
So what
we see that went out. That is spooky.
Yeah,
looking.
That went out to the investigators and the analysis. And it hadn't been tampered with in any way. It's a legitimate photograph. But we don't know what that anomaly is.
Right.
We can't say it's a Bigfoot for certain.
Okay. And do you think, as a result of all these things that you've seen, that there is a specific kind of creature, if you like, that might exist in lots of different parts of the world that is some kind of missing link or something like that?
I do. That's my personal opinion. Yeah. I believe that somewhere down the hominid line, maybe possibly a cousin or a brother,
yeah.
in the same way that monkeys and apes and lemurs and chimps, we're all kind of genetically linked.
Yeah.
And yes, the missing link is great for me. I often look at Hylobogensis because he was in the UK all those many thousands of years ago. Could it be an offshoot in some way? You know, there are many theories as to what they are.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Well, listen, Deborah, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. And I suppose we shouldn't be that surprised that the Daily Star got a couple of things wrong when they reported the story.
Not at all. It's going to be the first time.
They do keep us entertained, though, but thank you very much indeed. Deborah Hart-Hatswell there, cryptid and paranormal investigator. I mean, you know, some of this stuff is pretty amazing. And I've spent a long time talking to people about some of this stuff. And if you think that there is no such thing as, you know, strange creatures or maybe even aliens, then I think if you're able to write that off, then you must have a very closed mind, I'm afraid. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. A herd of 20,000 elephants is heading for Germany after the break. And more on those pesky NHS waiting lists. Some more big stuff is coming. Back after this. Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, the NHS waiting list could be as high as almost 10 million. That's 2 million higher than official figures have shown thus far. That's according to new data from the Office for National Statistics, which also reveals that more than 1.3 million people say they've been waiting for more than a year. NHS data only shows a backlog of just over 300,000 appointments. And as it couldn't get any worse for the health service, the GP surgery in Kent is asking patients to bring their own batteries for blood pressure and heart checks in order to clamp down on waste. Amazing. Joining me now is a former NHS Trust chair, Mr. Martin Gower. Martin, welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Nice to see you.
Well, good evening, Mike. It's very nice to see you too.
Well, I mean, I can tell you that this is an even lower figure than actually the true one is, because when the numbers were running up above 7 million, I was told that there was a further 10 million people waiting for secondary sort of procedures. You know, they might have been seen for the first part, but not for the second part. So actually the true figure for people waiting for procedures and operations on the NHS is probably close to about 20 million, which is a third of the country practically.
Yeah, I mean, the data is quite confusing actually, Mike. I mean, in the story that appeared in one of the national newspapers today, it compared the 9.7 million people waiting for an appointment against the 6.3 million individuals waiting for care.
Yes.
Now, I think there might be a little bit of double counting here. There are people who are waiting for GP appointments. We know that. We are waiting for people who are waiting for referrals to treatment. Mm. There are people who are waiting for scans.
Right.
Some of them will be the same people, but they're at a different stage in the queue. That all being said, it's a pretty awful situation to be in.
Well, particularly given that one of the five sort of promises that Rishi Sunak made at the beginning of last year in January was to reduce NHS waiting times. And in fact, they've done nothing but go up.
Yeah, and I think that was an inevitability. I mean, I think, Mike, a lot of things are going on, but after the COVID situation, where basically the NHS turned the majority of its efforts into COVID, I was still there at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. But, I mean, we were constantly told this was the only game in town. We had Zoom meetings with NHS England, and all we discussed was COVID.
Yeah.
And there were people, well-respected medics, who were warning that with all this the request to protect the NHS, there was going to be a growth in the severity, the acuity of patient presentations, but B, in a whole line of people who hadn't presented to a GP in order to protect the NHS, and then it all flooded on after the restrictions were lifted. And there are still some particularly elderly people who are quite cautious about asking to see their GP. They still feel they ought not to be doing it. Right. This is quite wrong, and it's a mess. I mean, we've talked before, the system isn't working. We are in, with the NHS, a fearful mess, and I rather fear it's going to be years and years and years if and when we get out of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've said earlier on today in the show that it's not fit for purpose. I mean, I think that's very clear. There may be parts of it that work. There may be bits of it that can still help you out if you're lucky enough to find the right part of it. But for many people now, the NHS is not even an option. And what I've been seeing lately as well is more and more people seeking some kind of private solution, whether it's joining up with a health insurance company, whether it's going to a private hospital and trying to make some kind of plan to pay for it. People have just had enough. They're not even bothering anymore.
No, I think that's true. Actually, I think the NHS have given up to some degree because they're commissioning the private sector enormously. I mean, if for example... I know a number of people, elderly people, have had cataract operations. They're all being done in the private sector, and they're being done in the private sector by the monies coming from the NHS.
Yes.
And somebody I had recently I spoke to who'd had a cataract operation, the doctor who did the operation in the private sector said, "We do 20 a day cataract operations here, whereas in an NHS hospital, they do 8. And that tells you a bit as well about what's going on.
Exactly.
And when it comes to waiting lists and appointments and people on waiting lists, the whole situation of actually having to refer people, of the letters going to and fro, the appointments that are made and then not kept, people actually not even showing up sometimes for appointments in outpatients and GPs, that did not attend rate. I mean, all of these things are just making it a complete mess.
Yeah.
No, I mean, and it's going to take a long, long time to get... Sorry, Mike.
No, I was going to say, I talk to anyone about the NHS and they've got a story like that, you know, that their relative or their parents or somebody that they know was waiting for an appointment. They never got the letter. By the time they got the letter, it was already past the point at which they should have turned up for the appointment, you know, and all that kind of thing. Just basic stuff that they don't seem to be able to get right. And now asking people to turn up with batteries, you know, when you're going to see a doctor... I mean, for God's sake, you might as well turn up with one of those, you know, operation kits that you give to kids. You know, see if you can get the see if you get the appendix out with that little, you know, screwdriver.
Yeah, should I bring a scalpel with me?
Right.
But for my operation, I mean, the idea that that's going to save waste is absolutely ludicrous. I could spend 10 minutes and tell places how to look to cut back on waste. It's not difficult.
Yeah.
It's really not difficult. Mm. And. But that, I mean, that story about the GP surgery in Kent asking people to bring their own batteries is so crazy. I mean, it's just laughable. It really is. I think the other thing, though, I would say, Mike, to have a little bit of balance, I mean, we have a number of friends and relations who have been undergoing various procedures from the NHS. And generally speaking, they've not been too bad.
Yeah.
In fact, they've been rather good. Very prompt.
Yeah.
My own family, my wife had to go to the A&E about a year ago. Very good service. The paramedics turned up on time. She got straight into was admitted straight away. There, 24 hours, dealt with, all very good. I had shingles, and that was dealt with by my GP surgery very, very efficiently. We have friends in Nottinghamshire who have had a good experience. A friend whose wife, she has had cancer. The worst place we found actually was, believe it or not, Wales, where we have relations and their experiences there are truly awful.
Yes. Well, it's the one place where the NHS is actually worse than it is in England, and that's in Wales, which doesn't bode terribly well for the Labour Party taking over in the autumn.
Not well at all.
No. But they're going to have nothing much to work with, are they? They're going to have to try and make it work somehow, because they keep telling us how brilliant the NHS was when Tony Blair and Gordon Brown had it. But that was before everybody had to figure out how to pay back the debts.
Well, also, never forget that in the Tony Blair era, we spent billions on a computer system for the NHS that never worked. So you know, a lot of money was wasted. A lot of money was thrown at it. A lot was swallowed up in salaries. And actually, the lack of accessibility to GPs was very much caused by the contract that was negotiated by the Labour government under Tony Blair, which basically took away the necessity for them to work weekends. In fact, the BMA were amazed that they were actually being paid a lot more for doing quite a lot less.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the reasons we're in a mess with the GPs and primary care. Mm. I do think that ultimately there's going to be need to be honesty in our health system, and the bit of honesty most needed is that actually politicians really aren't the best people to run your health systems.
I'll leave you with that thought, Martin, because I'm going to debate that with my panel here. Martin Gower, thank you very much indeed. I've got Mike Candice and Andrew back. I mean, my problem with the criticism of politicians who have ruined the NHS is that they might have been, you know, sort of blamed for part of what went wrong. But the NHS is a massive organisation employing 2 million people. An awful lot of them are managers. And these are the people who are not getting it right. Surely, to heavens, the NHS must take some blame for their own mismanagement of their own organisation.
Well, there was a think tank report the other week suggesting that NHS England should be abolished.
Yeah.
The central controlling body
and more power
given to the 42 ICS areas in England as well.
Yeah.
The difference is that would then create a difference in service. There isn't a guiding mind at the centre of it. And we saw this during the pandemic, Mike. When the health secretary wanted to do something, they'd issue an instruction, nothing would get down to the actual operational level. It's too big an organisation. Mm. It's too disparate. There's no central command and control.
Yes.
If the government wants to do something good, it wants the Department of Health to exert more leadership. If they're going to continue with the system, they need more control. They need more emphasis on
outcomes. But isn't that what NHS England is supposed to do, though? I mean, Candice, you're having a baby in a very short time from now. I presume you're going through the NHS with that. How are you finding that?
Yeah, because, I mean, you can't really get any coverage for maternity care. Right. And the thing is, the cost can just go so out of control if you go private.
Right.
Because you don't know what you'll need after the birth. You could need various specialists.
Right.
And then you'll just get some enormous bills.
Right.
I mean, there's no way we're going to do that.
Right.
That's the only thing, you know, when people talk about privatisation, they do need to be realistic about how much it will cost people.
Yes.
It really will. I mean, I've got relatives who sell health insurance in other countries.
Yeah.
And they say once people start making claims, the premiums get insane. So, I mean, it's, you know, although having a private system in some ways is good because the incentives are good. Everything becomes patient-focused.
Yeah, it feels to me that we've already got a kind of mixed system, though, because, you know, if you go to a private doctor or a private hospital, there are plenty of people using that place. Some of them, as Martin was saying there, have been sent there by the NHS because they haven't got the bandwidth to deal with it all. But I also can talk to you about when I was living in America, where a friend of mine was a doctor, and down in North Carolina, because there was such a high incidence of lawsuits for giving birth and for obstetrics, that a lot of doctors just wouldn't do it.
Yes.
They were just like, well, we can't get cover for that, so we're not going to do anything to do with birthing babies.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's one of the most litigious sides.
I mean, the NHS loses millions every year from lawsuits that people sue them over.
Yeah.
And there's always two sides to it. One is that they're all saying there's lack of funds in the NHS, but also is about the efficiency.
Yeah.
And the system is horrendous.
I mean, I think we can all agree there's not a lack of funds. There is an overburden of people who don't do anything medical, it seems to me. The 50% of the people working there, which is about 1 million people now, don't actually do anything which is of any use to man or beast in terms of medical help.
Yeah, but by lack of funds, I mean in terms of paying people an appropriate fee. I know that there's a controversial side about how much that should be, but a lot of people just cannot live on a certain wage. But there's two sides to it. One is...
If you give up nursing and take up being a Twitter announcer for one of the hospitals,
you'll
get a lot more money.
They will.
They get paid 40 grand to be a Twitter sort of aficionado for Guy's Hospital, but to be a nurse, they only get 25. It's madness.
Yeah. It is, and it's something that people who work on the NHS talk about a lot. You know, they're saying that the paperwork I have to do really takes away from my clinical care.
Right.
And the thing is, people get genuinely fatigued, and then they get compassion fatigue because they're so tired and they're doing so many different things that then patients sort of become an annoyance.
Yeah.
They do, and people have spoken about this, and it's a really difficult thing to talk about. Mm. But when you are overworked and you're not able to focus on the right priorities, you do start to become irritable, and I mean, we've all experienced this.
Yeah, I get irritable all the time, but it's just because of my age.
But it's hard, like when I've given birth. birth and you're needy and you really need someone, and that person is just like, oh, leave me alone. I've
but
got
the
too
admin
much.
And the various laborious tasks, that's where my pet about AI, artificial intelligence, well, can massively.
Any kind of intelligence would be better than what they do at the moment. Let's talk about Bigfoot, because that happened just before we talked about the NHS. I'm fascinated by these kind of stories because people do see things. I used to do overnight radio where you'd get calls from all sorts of people ringing in to say they'd seen something, or, you know, they thought they'd seen an alien, you know, and there's no real explanation for all of it, you know. They can't all be cranks, they can't all be nutters and maniacs. I think there's every possibility that there are things out there that we don't know about.
It's got to be right. It's such arrogance to assume that there isn't. And I think that there has to be. Question everything. What I love about this story is that this is a spooky picture,
I think, where you can see the head and shoulders. I mean, you see these shadowy figures. Yeah. You know, and you can dismiss it and go, oh, I'm too clever for all that. But I think you can't dismiss it in many ways. I mean, especially if you look at parts of the world, you know, where there's literally nothing for thousands of miles. Parts of America, parts of, you know, Asia, parts of Australia, parts of probably Africa, but there's literally nothing there. Yeah. And you're going to tell me that...
And we're discovering things on a daily basis. Yeah. They're talking about dinosaurs, which we hadn't even heard of beforehand, being discovered, the skeletons of those sort of... What I love in this story, it was in The Star, they at the end, very end of it, say, while neither man saw the creature, they heard these wonderful growls, and they never want to hear those again. It's the most frightening thing they've ever heard. So it's quite
I take it none of you have ever seen anything.
Friday
night, middle of London.
We find new species every day in the ocean. We find undiscovered species in rainbows. We find species that we thought were extinct.
Right.
Yeah. You know, the universe is a vast
and the missing link thing has still never been solved.
Yeah,
you know, there's still a lot of people that want to have that explained properly. And the lady we interviewed there, she said that she saw this sort of abominable snowman type figure in Manchester, which I think is entirely believable. You know, anyone who's been to Manchester will tell you there's interesting people walking around up there.
Definitely.
Some of them may be closer to the missing link that we know. Who can say? Anyway, let's talk about takeaways. Apparently, takeaway food has now hit... I mean, you talk about what's a boom industry.
Yes.
And unfortunately, this is one of them. And it's probably not the best thing to be sort of waving the British flag about going, isn't it brilliant? We're number one at something. You know, people, the 50% more takeaway food is being ordered now.
And
I mean, I must admit, it drives me mad when I drive around London. These guys on mopeds.
Yeah.
You know, everywhere.
Everywhere you go, they're coming round you from that side, from that side. You know, they have no apparent care about zebra crossings. They don't stop for anybody. And, you know, people are just ordering food constantly, all the time now.
Yes.
Breakfast, lunch, dinner.
It's a convenience, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's also, I think it's part of the habit people got into during the pandemic. Mm. But also, as well, it's a good example of how our diet and personal habits have actually worsened in recent years as well. Mm. There's an underlying public health crisis here to do with obesity. And yes, you can order healthy food as well, but McDonald's have switched successfully to doing muck delivery now as well. And if you're outside London or in any of the towns at all, you're more likely to have access to that than, say, you know, these sort of salad places.
The thing that also annoys me is if you ever do go to any of these places where you get deliveries from, you know, you can't get into it because there's all these mopeds outside waiting. You know, they were sort of standing there. I was in London, went to Shake Shack once with my kids. And actually, from the first time I'd been there, the service was awful. The food was awful because all they were concentrating on was giving it to the people who were lining up with crash helmets on.
And they put little hatches in the side of a lot of the shops so that just so these guys can go there, obtain their orders, then move off again as well.
So I'm going to ask you an honest question now. When was the last time you ordered a takeaway?
Yesterday.
There you go. And what was it?
It was a pizza.
A pizza. See, I mean, you can make pizza.
My wife doesn't know that.
Don't tell her. So
we ordered food and it arrived late and stone cold.
Yes. That's the thing I've never understood about ordering from, say, somewhere like McDonald's.
Yes.
Because surely when it gets to you, it's cold.
Yeah,
and it's a hamburger. Exactly. If you've got metal lettuce in it, you have to take it all apart and put it in a microwave. What's the point?
Absolutely. And it's so easy to basically do things at home now. I've been a trustee of a charity about food redistribution.
Yes.
There is so much waste.
Oh, massive.
And you work on that sort of basis. But actually preparing healthy meals at home is not that difficult.
No, it's not. But people will... You know, as Mike says, order in because sometimes it's just easier.
Yeah.
So what's the last... You haven't answered the last time you had a takeaway.
I can't remember. I mean, zillions of years ago.
Really?
Seriously. I think I live right in the heart of London. It's not that difficult to walk to a lot of those fast food places or to get a healthy meal.
You always go and collect your order and do... Hang on.
Oh, I send people out.
Send
out the staff. Yeah. Now, apparently there's a row going on between Botswana and Germany.
Yes.
Because it's all about trophy hunting.
Yeah.
And seemingly they're threatening to send 20,000 elephants to Germany. I don't know how they would send them. Presumably they wouldn't march them over the Alps.
Would they like Hannibal?
Yeah, they could just reenact it and say, actually, no, we're doing it for a documentary.
Yes.
And they just turn up.
I love, so the issue is here that the export of trophy stuff is quite a big industry in Botswana, and the bands are impoverishing the country.
Yes.
I like the idea the president said he can't, you know, the country can't afford to feed its own people, but he's going to have the manpower and the resources to send 20,000 elephants.
Right.
To, you know, thousands
of miles. I've also heard people from Africa speaking about how it employs an awful lot of people.
Yes.
The business of trophy hunting.
They have
it's a slightly double-edged sword. They have a different view. They say, well, it's all very well you Westerners coming here and telling us that we're doing it all wrong and it's really cruel.
Yeah.
But actually, there's a lot of people here who would be destitute if we didn't have it.
I don't like trophy hunting, but if you go to African countries, they do have a different view. They sort of see elephants as destroying the vegetation. They see them as an actual danger, actually, in many ways. They don't. They have a. They view wild animals very, very, very differently in terms of how to manage it. I mean, Botswana is a middle-income country, as far as I know.
It's the same argument they do for about fox hunting. They're saying that in certain places, this is what happens. They're a big menace, and that's why you have to cull them. Yes. But you have to do things humanely, and this is the thing. You can't basically confuse the two arguments. A trophy hunting is abhorrent. Yeah. And seeing these glorious animals being destroyed for their tusks or whatever is abhorrent. What their answer is, look, the elephants are a big nuisance. They are a big nuisance, and they're very threatening. I've been in amongst all sorts of...
Yeah, but is the answer also a foreign country coming in and saying you shouldn't be doing that, therefore we're going to somehow punish you?
Exactly. Well, it's not going to happen in reality, but I think, although I love the vision of the Hannibal...
No, I don't mean that. I mean the fact that Germany's been critical, or that Britain would be critical, or that any country in Europe would be critical of it and say that you have to stop doing
it. If you're a key export market and you suddenly decide to turn off the tap for these particular things, obviously, you know, I agree with Andrew entirely, it's a horrible practice, but you should have a role in creating another demand. Say, OK, well, we send tourists to Botswana to, you know, do ecotourism with the elephants there. There'd be a huge demand for that as well.
Well, they wouldn't. There'd just be a lot of limp-wristed people from Chiswick going, let's go and, you know, do a bit of ecotourism. It'd all be wealthy people, you know, and you'd be still enslaving... But you'd be enslaving the locals, wouldn't you?
Well, I think
I'm surprised you'd opt for that, Mike, to be honest. That's shocking. Absolutely shocking. Now, come up, the Plank of the Week returns tomorrow night. And this week, I'm back, and the University of California is nominated for banning white people from its community farm. Or possibly not. Well, the Plank of the Week goes to the people behind the glass. Never mind. Oh, we've got it now. I'll go for it now. Go on.
So Saturdays are reserved for BIPOC, which I thought BIPOC was some Star Wars creature.
Yeah.
But actually, it's actually Black, Indigenous and people of colour. I don't know why you have to say Black and Indigenous, because people of colour surely includes everybody there.
Yeah, well, you would have thought so. But, I've never heard of BIPOC before. That's a good one, that.
But it's remarkable, because actually now what we're having is a world where, you know, far from trying to fight segregation, actually the anti-race activists are trying to enforce progressive segregation as being progressive for race for race relations, and that's what you get in this world. When you combine identity politics with safe spaces, you get segregation now.
Well, there you go, 7 o'clock tomorrow. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up after the break, we're going to look at electric cars, finally on the back burner, and all of the best of tomorrow's news. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for this.
The World of Woke.
Fire! That's the only time we hear about electric cars in the news anymore. These heavy tarmac-crushing beasts of burden are starting to really tank in sales, like we've been saying for years. Car makers have only pushed them because they have a just about acceptable range. Governments were only too happy to virtue signal them up the M1 and back again about the promises of net zero targets and extensive infrastructure. Well, it turns out it was all a big fat lie. To hell with the yawning cobalt mines, gargantuan landfills packed with toxic battery acid and extortionate price tags, these rolling glaciers are melting away and have been declared ungreen and are now officially unpopular. Sales have slumped, the market share is racing to petrol power, pushed on us whilst being taxed to the hilt for refusing. The British public are voting with their feet. Manufacturers, too, are cancelling plans to go all electric and are continuing to cancel petrol models. We warned, we wailed, and we can proudly now say, I think we won. That was The World of Woke.
The World of Woke.
Funny enough, I was talking to a couple of drivers in America who were saying that the electric revolution over there is dying out as well.
Right.
Because people just can't drive far enough. You know what it's like in America? They drive hundreds and hundreds of miles just to go to work, you know, and it's like they don't work very well.
That's the issue.
Yeah, but speaking of travel, the scrapping of 100 millilitre liquid travel rules at Heathrow, Gatwick and Stansted are going to be delayed because they haven't got round to it. Terribly British story. I came back into Heathrow. In fact, when I went out from Heathrow last week, what I didn't know was that they've apparently changed the rule on taking a little plastic bag full of all your stuff and putting it out. You can now leave it in the bag.
Yes.
I didn't know that had happened. I'd seen it at City Airport, where you can just leave it in your suitcase and they just scan it all together. But when I came back, basically, one of the things that I noticed was that the escalators didn't work at Heathrow.
Right.
And you walk, like, for about what seems about 2 miles, and then you get to one escalator, which goes up to take you into sort of baggage reclaim and customs. And it was out of order. And I just went, how bleeding British can you get? You know, we got to Kennedy Airport, and it's modern, and it's fine. And it didn't used to be, but they're still much better, it seems, at updating their airports. I mean, Heathrow is an ancient airport now.
It is extraordinary. I went on the very first day booked with the family when Heathrow Terminal 5 was there. And you might remember, I thought, we'd just go up to Scotland. It'd be dead easy. Right. And, of course, all the things didn't work. So we ended up spending the
Terminal 5 is a nice terminal.
It's lovely now.
It's too busy all the time if you go there. And British Airways is not what it was, I don't think.
No. I mean, I know people who've had such bad experiences lately.
Yeah.
Like getting like a flight cancelled at the last minute. And a family I knew ended up landing in Cape Town at 3 a.m. in the morning with a baby. Luckily, they had family there that could come pick them up from the airport.
They were hoping to go to Edinburgh, weren't they?
That's right.
It works on that basis.
It's like the old joke. You go up to the British Airways counter and say, can you send one of these bags to Rio de Janeiro and the other one to Hong Kong, please? And they're like, why do you want to do that? You say, because that's what you did last time. You know. Scoop is all over the papers, has been all over the papers for about a week. I think it starts on Netflix this weekend. Mike's very excited
about
it.
I'm very excited.
He loves it.
Quite a good friend of Sam McAllister's, and so I mean, I've been following her journey from, you know, deciding to leave the BBC, writing the book, getting Netflix to pick it up, to this week she was in New York posing in front of this giant poster, electronic poster in Times Square, and she was like, it's just unreal, surreal. But it's supposed to be a very good sort of study in journalism. It's not always easy to make good movies about journalism, but this one apparently is pretty good.
And brilliant casting, I have to say. The look-alike, what they've done with the hair and so on and so forth. It's wonderful stuff. It is the stuff. You couldn't make it up, could you? And the whole Prince Andrew thing. The
Prince Andrew
interview with that sort of
stuff.
Well,
let's
have a look at that. And
I mean, they have taken some license, I suppose, but I mean, I wonder whether he's going to be watching it. I wonder if it's Prince Andrew.
I can guarantee him and his lawyers.
Does he have Netflix in his Windsor hideaway cottage with 68,000 bedrooms?
And the corgis there as well, watching it with him, presumably.
Apparently they all watched the Crown. Brown. They all watched it.
Yes. Well, I mean, did they, though? I mean, the Crown would say that.
Apparently, they did.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with The Crown is that it was blurring the lines between what's fact and what's fiction.
Yeah.
Right. And that licence, the artistic licence of the anthology, is a brilliant series.
But that's the problem with all of these things. I'm assuming that in Scoop there might well be a bit of licence.
Oh, yeah, they'll be take it with a pinch of salt.
You know, they won't do everything exactly.
By Sam McAllister's book, you've got to get the gospel version. Yeah.
But, I mean, her book has got all of it in there. And, I mean, she has told me the story many times of how she couldn't actually believe what she was hearing. She was sitting on a sort of... Probably this will be portrayed in the film. She was sort of sitting behind Andrew with, you know, sort of on the floor opposite Emily Maitlis, who was asking the questions. And with every kind of answer, she was kind of going, does he know what he's saying? And at the end, when he said that, you know, he was quite pleased with it.
Yes.
Went off to tell his mother how well it had gone.
Yes.
And he then asked to show Emily Maitlis round if she wanted to see round the palace. And she was like, oh, that's very nice. And Sam basically took the you know, whatever the memory stick that it was on, and just ran out of the building. She thought, well, somebody's going to go, don't let them out with this. Well, this is way too dangerous.
Yeah, so scared that they would realise what they've done.
But they didn't. They clearly didn't.
Quite extraordinary.
Truly iconic.
Now, we haven't got much time. The Financial Times, unusually, for the first time, I think, ever, has got a picture of somebody from Kiss on the front.
Isn't it glorious? And what I love about this story is, as predicted, it's all about rights and artists' rights. And Kiss have done this one wonderful 300 million rights deal.
I'm amazed how successful Kiss are. I think they're awful.
You're terrible.
Absolutely.
They're iconic. The look
is,
you know.
I mean, I've actually met Gene Simmons.
Yes,
he's a good friend of Piers Morgan's because he used to be on The Apprentice with him. So he would get him on whenever he was in England.
Right.
He would be on his show and he was upstairs. Yeah. A very funny guy, actually.
Very funny.
But I can't stand their music.
No.
Right. I don't know.
I hated that whole era.
Yeah. What, sort of glam rock?
Oh, and hair rock, and then it all got smashed to pieces by yes. grunge, which I love.
Grunge, I definitely think, is a much better choice. But, yeah, so they've done a rights deal for $300 million, basically yes. giving away all of their music, which is what a lot of people have done. Yeah, Springsteen's done it. Absolutely. I think Bowie was the first one to do it. Yeah. And it's an amazing way to...
It's great. Just get loads of cash. You want to have the money now, so there's that sort of stuff. Right. But it's also with the same company, with ABBA, so Pop House, this new company, and Bjorn is behind all that sort of stuff. So they're going to do this virtual reality version of Kiss, showing them in their prime. Yeah. They have the longevity.
And they must believe that they're going to make that money back. So
oh, yes, absolutely.
You know, for the rest of time. Finally, we've only got a few minutes, but or less than that, probably, 20 seconds. Chinese state banks hold the key role in the future of Thames Water. Probably the worst thing that could happen to Thames Water, who can't control anything.
I mean, buried away in this article is the fact that the shareholders have asked Ofwat, the regulator, to approve a 56% real terms rise in bills by 2030 as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's absurd.
But well, they're unable to pay the $190 million loan. I mean, so there it is. Yeah. This is they're not going to be the only
the
company.
End. You've got to stop talking. It's all over. You've been watching The Independent Republic and Mike Graham. Thank you to all of you. Plank of the Week tomorrow, 7 o'clock. See you next week.